Way back near the beginning of the channel, I made a brief video covering the Royal Navy and its involvement in eliminating the Atlantic slave trade. However, that video was pretty darn short by the later standards of the channel for Wednesday videos, and the fine folk over on Patreon wanted a more extensive coverage of these efforts. So here we are. Incidentally, if you want to get a vote in on some of the subjects the channel covers, you can, of course, join up on Patreon as well. Link in the description below. Before we start the main part of the video, though, I thought we should probably clear up a few myths about the British Empire and the Atlantic slave trade, ideally to avoid them being spammed in the comment section and wasting everybody's time. Firstly, was Britain the biggest slave trader on the transatlantic route? No, that would be the Portuguese, who win the dubious honour of largest slave traders by well over a million people, shipping, according to the most heavily researched sources I could find, just under 6 million slaves in total. Britain comes a distant second, with a still considerable just over 3 million shipped, and then everybody else, France, the Netherlands, Spain, the US, and various others in descending order, combine to make up just a little bit more than Britain's total overall. As an aside, it should be noted that who is recorded as shipping the slaves doesn't necessarily align with where those slaves went, as well as obvious issues like, say, slaves that were shipped to the 13 colonies before the War of Independence would obviously be listed as being transported on British ships going to British territory, and then after the war, those same ships going to that same territory would be American ships landing in American territory. Slave ships would also be obviously selling ships in foreign ports at various points, although the frequency of that occurring varied, and slavers were known to fly false flags, something which will come up quite a lot during the video. Secondly, did Britain start the transatlantic slave trade, something that crops up occasionally on the less well-informed portions of the internet? Well, no. That would actually be the Spanish and the Portuguese, and indeed one of the first attempts by what at the time was England's merchants to get involved with the slave trade was Drake and Hawkins trying to break into the pre-existing Spanish slave market, an effort that ended up in the Battle of San Juan de Ulua, as the Spanish wanted to keep all the profits from the growing slave trade to themselves. And thirdly, did Britain try to end the slave trade simply due to its advantages in starting the Industrial Revolution, which supposedly reduces the need for slaves, and thus they were just trying to undercut their competitors, since Britain was no longer really in a position to profit from slavery? This is a more complicated argument, but one that has also been cropping up again in the less intellectually gifted portions of the internet, as it's not true in the slightest, as not only had the Industrial Revolution really barely begun by the time Britain banned the international slave trade, but the areas of industry that the Industrial Revolution affected first, things like steam pumps in mines, were not areas of industry where slaves were utilised. The industries that were quite heavy in slave use were actually some of the very last to be mechanised, and some of those industries are still only semi-mechanised at best, even today. One of the other areas, apart from pumping out mines, that the early Industrial Revolution affected significantly was the production of cotton, with spinning machinery taking over from manual labour when it came to turning raw cotton into thread and fabric, but that industry was being conducted in Britain, and the increased efficiency of the mechanical devices actually increased demand for raw cotton, and that was, of course, itself being produced in very large quantities by slave labour, so it actually increased the demand for slavery. And as we'll see throughout the video, there was a constant and very loud segment of the British establishment during anti-slavery operations who not only wanted those operations to be reduced or ceased entirely, but also were consistently lobbying for slavery to be made legal again. And that segment of society was almost entirely made up of the various industrial magnates and owners whose very specific argument was that the inability to import slaves, and later on to own slaves at all, was badly hampering their productivity and competitiveness compared to other nations' colonies who were, of course, still importing and utilising slave labour. And they would also be using their influence and money to try and get captured slavers' leniency in some cases where they were brought to court. Now, of course, does this mean that Britain wasn't trading very heavily in slaves at the time? No, of course they were. Much as we already established, pretty much everyone else was, and yes, they were relatively successful at it. But as with anything, if you are going to condemn someone or something or some organisation for their actions, it doesn't help your argument when you just make up blatantly untrue stuff about it. There are more than enough horrors to do with the slave trade without inventing things out of whole cloth. Now, with that out of the way, let's begin our coverage of the actual slave trade and its suppression. The abolitionist movement in Britain had begun to gain strength around the mid-1700s, partly as a general moral movement, but it also had strong religious undertones. Some of the leading figures in the early abolitionist movement being, you might find surprisingly, former slave traders who had subsequently become fervent believers and sought to atone for their previous conduct, in part, by campaigning heavily against it. This didn't, of course, prevent others who also professed to share their faith from continuing in the slave trade, but the dual physical and spiritual nature of the abolitionist movement cannot be denied. In 1772, there was a famous court case, often known as the Somerset case, after the slave in question. Having sought to escape his master while in England, James Somerset, a slave who had been purchased over in what was then the 13 colonies, had been apprehended with the intention of his master to ship him off to the Caribbean to work on a plantation, since he decided it was more trouble than it was worth to keep him around. This was challenged in court, and Lord Mansfield, the presiding judge, eventually rendered a decision that essentially boiled down to the fact that there wasn't actually any law in England that explicitly permitted slavery or conditions like it. And on the principle that foreign laws didn't apply on English soil, and obviously vice versa, and that slavery allowed such complete control over a person's destiny by another person that it could only be lawful if it was specifically enacted by law, Mansfield ordered Somerset to be set free, noting in part with regards to slavery, "It is so odious that nothing can be suffered to support it but positive law. Whatever inconveniences therefore may follow from the decision, I cannot say this case is allowed or approved by the law of England, and therefore the black must be discharged." While it was a relatively narrow ruling in and of itself, it did set in motion a series of events. It made the holding of slaves in England itself practically untenable in most cases, as it was cited as precedent, and it started a significant debate as to why laws in various British colonies allowed slavery if it was not enforceable on British soil. And of course, it gave additional fuel to the abolitionist movement. Further events shortly thereafter escalated matters. During the American War of Independence, it was decreed that any slave that reached a British ship or fort was free. And after the war, the nascent US government demanded the return of what they termed stolen property. But despite Britain only just about managing to salvage the overall war situation at the time, they refused these demands, and the freed slaves were relocated to other British-held territory as free men and women. The impact of the Somerset ruling was also cited in a number of US state courts, as the newly formed USA began to decide on a state-by-state basis as to whether or not they would permit slavery. Now, you'll note I've used English law while referring also at the same time to Britain as a whole. That's because Scotland had, and still has, its own legal system, and by the end of the 1770s, a separate case there, influenced by and citing the Somerset ruling, determined that Scottish law also did not permit slavery. So by the end of the 1770s, by direct ruling or by inference, it was essentially illegal to keep a slave in the British Isles. Over the next couple of decades, various abolitionist laws or proposals for said laws were introduced in Parliament. Some proposed a more immediate ban, others proposed a gradual abolition, the latter generally being somewhat more popular, but in the early 1790s, when it looked like maybe something might actually get a majority vote, the resumption of war with France both pushed the issue to the back burner generally and harmed the overall cause specifically, since many of the leading abolitionists had expressed common cause with some of the French revolutionaries who also wanted to end slavery. But the subsequent excesses of elements of the revolutionary movement, plus the whole going to war part, meant that these associations now ended up losing support for the anti-slavery movement in the UK for a while. However, by 1802, things took an upswing. There was a temporary peace, and Napoleon ordered slavery in the French Empire to be resumed. While that wasn't good news for slaves in the French Empire, it did sever most perceived association between France and the abolitionist movement, and the imprisonment of a leading slavery advocate, Lord Melville, for separate financial corruption charges, combined with a new pro-abolition prime minister, meant that in 1806, a bill was finally passed that prohibited the import of any more slaves into any British territory, and also forbade any British ship or British finance to be used in the slave trade. This didn't do anything for those already enslaved in the British colonies, obviously. That would have to wait till later, but it was a start. In 1807, another bill went a step further, declaring the entire activity of slave trading to be a criminal enterprise, and thus not only not permitted at all in British territory, but it also closed a loophole from the previous year where foreign ships could still bring slaves to British colonies. The strongest voices raised against it were from MPs who represented various industries and trades that heavily used slaves, arguing that the damage to the economy of the colonies would be vast, a similar argument which they'd put forward before against the previous attempts to pass such laws, but with the abolitionist campaign making the issue as much a matter of faith and morality as simple law and justice, this time the pro-slavery groups were significantly outvoted. The fact that some abolitionists sold the entire thing to the press as yet another way for Britain to show itself superior to the French also helped to win votes in some areas. These efforts back home were also accompanied by renewed efforts to support the then newly founded colony of Sierra Leone, which had been originally set up in the late 1780s to establish a place in Africa where freed slaves could return without the risk of being enslaved again. That particular attempt had gotten off to a rocky start between landing in poor weather and various hostile neighbours, but in the 1790s the colony had begun to gain strength. The following year, in 1808, the USA also passed a bill that was similar to the 1806 one in the UK. It prohibited the importation of or trade in slaves by US ships. However, there was a big difference in both the willingness and, to be honest, capability of the two nations to actually enforce these laws. Slave trading with the US by various nations, including by US slavers, would therefore continue for some time, as the law was rarely, if ever, enforced. But even though Britain was at war with most of Europe in 1807, the Royal Navy began to divert resources to enforce the UK's new abolition law almost immediately. The Royal Navy Squadron in the Caribbean, for instance, was present largely for protecting British colonies and for attacking French and Spanish ships that showed up in the area, although the Spanish would switch sides in 1808. However, the frigates of the squadron quickly found an additional job seizing slave ships, helped in part by the blockade conducted by other elements of the Royal Navy on the other side of the Atlantic, which was limiting the number of hostile warships that they had to deal with. Some traders in Britain tried to get around the new laws by putting their ships under foreign flags of convenience, and in the closing years of the 1800s, dozens of ships were suddenly found in Liverpool docks to be flying Portuguese and American flags, and dozens more actually foreign ships found themselves still able to buy slaving gear from various British traders. However, the Royal Navy quickly began to seize some of these vessels for knowingly flying false flags, as well as for being slavers, since the Liverpool docks weren't exactly difficult to monitor, and the practice soon dried up, forcing those British ship owners to either trade in more mundane goods or try to become significantly more cunning in their efforts to continue slavery. But the changing face of war complicated matters. France being the enemy meant that blockading French and occupied ports was just a matter of general principle. But Portugal was an ally, and after the invasion of Portugal in 1807 and the Portuguese government's relocation to Brazil, it was also an ally in exile. This meant only limited pressure could be brought on the Portuguese to end their own slave trade, and they refused when such pressure was applied. Spain switching sides the next year actually caused more issues, since it meant Spanish slave ships could sail once again without being subject to general attack by the Royal Navy, lest it upset the delicate new alliance between the two nations. But, in any case, by 1808, the Admiralty had begun to establish a system to try and deal with the slave trade. An Admiralty Court was set up in Freetown, Sierra Leone, as this was closer to the main slave trading areas, and thus easier to get to and from rather than sending the ships all the way back to the UK. A captured slave ship would be sent there, the slaves would be freed, and the vessels would be condemned. There was also a system known as head money implemented. This added a bonus to the prize money for the ship itself, and was based on the number and types of slaves freed. If the slave ship happened to belong to a nation that Britain was at war with, then male slaves were valued at £40, female slaves at £30, and children under 14 at £10. If the slave ship was from a nation not currently at war with Britain, these values would be halved, but this was generally designed to serve three main purposes. Firstly, it meant there was a financial as well as a moral incentive to keep the slaves alive. Secondly, it provided some compensation against the risks of operating in the tropical and thus very often disease-infested waters. And thirdly, encouraged the crews to be quite vigorous in chasing down slave ships, as a vessel carrying several hundred slaves could see its value as a prize be increased by 4 to 5 times compared to the prize value of the ship itself, once the head money was taken into account. By early 1808, the first three Royal Navy vessels dedicated to anti-slavery operations were already working their way along the African coast. The 18-gun HMS Derwent was on direct patrol, while the 32-gun HMS Solebay and a smaller gun brig, the Tigress, had been sent down for a seemingly unlikely task, hydrography. The Admiralty had rapidly realised they didn't actually know the west coast of Africa all that well, but presumably the slavers did, and so one of their first tasks was to accurately chart the coasts, bays and inlets so that other Royal Navy ships could make better guesses on where the slavers would hide and could better pursue them safely. In the course of the first year of operations, the Derwent captured 9 ships, including 3 flying the US flag and 2 the Portuguese. Most of these ships were suspected of flying flags of convenience. In 1809, the 3 ships, plus a couple of others, joined forces and attacked the French colony of Senegal, which was serving as a privateer base, and the privateers were threatening to disrupt the anti-slavery work. This attack was initially aimed mostly at just taking out the privateers, but it snowballed into the surrender of the entire colony, although the Solebay was wrecked by river currents in the course of these events. She would be replaced by the 22-gun Crocodile in short order, but Captain Columbine, initially of the Solebay and now of the Crocodile, was also put in charge of Sierra Leone, as its most recent governor was being recalled, as he'd made some very public and pointed statements regarding the actions of his predecessors, who he charged with convincing some of the freed slaves into signing on as so-called apprentices, under terms that were barely any different from slavery, except for the fact that they were notionally being paid. As these accusations also implicated some of the more powerful anti-abolitionists back in the UK, they seemed to have used their influence to have him removed before he drew too much attention to the spectacle. The 3 ships were then sent the cutter Tickler to help with the shallower parts of the survey work, while the brig sloops Hawk and Dauntless also appeared for a few months each, as they were passing through on other duties, but had been given orders to stop over in the area and help out as best they could. By the start of 1810, around a dozen further slavers had been captured. While about half of them turned out to legitimately be flying flags of various countries as they'd claimed, and the ships were thus released, minus their slaves, the other half turned out to be flying false flags. Largely, this was a mixture of American and British ships flying false colours, and these ships were seized as well as having their slaves released. One was even turned into a tender to the Crocodile, thus augmenting the squadron's capabilities. Also notable in 1810 was a new treaty signed between Britain and Portugal. It was mostly a trade and economic treaty, and while it didn't stop the Portuguese slave trade entirely, it did forbid their ships from picking up slaves from anywhere that wasn't actually Portuguese territory, or from anywhere even within Portuguese territory that wasn't currently being used for slaving purposes, i.e. they couldn't start up new slave ports. This was designed to curtail the trade somewhat and pointed the way forward for future British treaty negotiations, where they were prepared to trade away other terms favourable to them in exchange for making inroads into that country's slave trade. Of course, this particular treaty was one between friends. A peace treaty with a defeated enemy would, of course, give Britain much more leverage. Also getting in on the action in 1810 was the privateer Dart, which had managed to secure a letter of marque to operate against slavers and rapidly brought in three Portuguese ships caught breaking the new treaty's terms. The Royal Navy also caught a trio of American slave ships flying false colours, this time Spanish and Swedish flags, but the Royal Navy was also active elsewhere. Intelligence was received that Tenerife was being used by British and American slave ships to receive Spanish paperwork from its corrupt governor. And so, over the summer, the 38-gun HMS Amelia was sent to patrol and inspect the ships in this area. As well as capturing a French privateer, the Amelia boarded almost two dozen ships and discovered a number of them were indeed flying false flags. However, by 1811, Captain Columbine had died of illness contracted through several years operating off the West African coast, but even though war was raging, his efforts had had some effect. By this point, a lot of the efforts by British ships to false flag themselves to keep on slaving had ended, as too many of them were being caught to make it profitable, and their owners' perfidy was being loudly publicised in the press back home. Overall, slave trading to the Caribbean was estimated to have dropped by about a third. But the continued efforts by some elements of British industry to either continue trading in slaves under false colours or to support and supply other foreign slaving trips led to the introduction of a new law called the Felonies Act. It meant that any British citizen found involved in slave trading in any way would face either a sentence of 3 to 5 years hard labour, or they would be transported to Australia with a maximum possible sentence of 14 years. It also extended prize money provisions for slave ships to definitively cover periods outside of any wartime at all. There was also an important precedent that was set by the case of an American ship that was caught sailing under false colours. Although she was carrying no slaves, she was clearly fitted out for slaving, and the court held that the ship could be seized and condemned due to the clear intention to carry out slaving, even if she wasn't actually having slaves aboard at the time. This in turn meant that various ships could be seized and condemned even without slaves on board if it was obvious what their intent was, and it also closed a loophole that some slavers had been using, which involved the rather sickening practice of throwing their slaves overboard when they were being pursued, as they would then argue that, well, they couldn't be seized when they were finally overhauled since they had no slaves aboard at the time. New ships had arrived, and more slavers were being seized, including more British ships found under false colours, and soon the first consignments of slaver crews in the British ships were being sentenced to transportation or hard labour under the Felonies Act. In late 1811, Captain Irby arrived with the Amelia, which we last saw patrolling off Tenerife, and within a couple of months he'd captured 8 slavers and dissuaded 3 more Portuguese ships which he'd found about to take on slaves in non-Portuguese ports. While Amelia led the new arrivals in a campaign up and down the coast, it seemed that not only were the slave ships getting more numerous, but they were also getting better at hiding. Complicating these matters was the declaration of war in June 1812 between Britain and America. On the one hand, this meant that any ship flying the American flag was now fair game as a prize of war, which did simplify things somewhat, but on the other hand, it meant the Royal Navy was now having to fight a campaign off the American East Coast to try and protect British merchant shipping from US warships and privateers, while also blockading most of Europe, which put some understandable strain on commitments to the West African coast. However, even in these conditions, Royal Navy ships continued their patrols. The 6th-rate frigate and former fireship HMS Tyse, under Captain Scobell, joined the effort and made use of her unusual profile to pretend to be another slaver ship, lowering some of her higher mast sections and using this disguise, as well as more conventional tactics, to take 4 slave ships in just 6 weeks. In late August, she captured the brig Flor d'America with 364 slaves aboard, and the British crew was so horrified at the conditions aboard, which were bad even for a slave ship, that they actually brought the slaves out on deck while they fumigated the ship's hold, and then they took the slave ship's crew, put them in a boat with just enough rations for them to make a voyage back to the African coast, and just left the crew adrift. The prevalence of disease on the station can't really be understated. When Thais, Amelia, and the sloop Kangaroo met up, the latter was effectively immobile due to the sheer numbers of incapacitated men, and the Amelia wasn't that far behind. But since Kangaroo was the smaller ship, it was proposed to transfer the healthiest of Amelia's crew to Kangaroo so that at least she and Thais could keep up their efforts. All 3 ships were, however, just about kept operational due to the sudden arrival of most of the crew from the brig HMS Daring, which had also been on anti-slavery patrol but had been pursued and driven ashore by a pair of French frigates, with the crew then escaping on small boats. These 2 French frigates badly hampered anti-slavery patrols, as although one of them managed to run itself aground in a storm, the other, the Arethuse, engaged the Amelia in a long and ultimately indecisive duel that nevertheless forced the Amelia, its rigging much damaged and its hull already badly worn out, to return to the UK for repairs. Soon enough, only Thais was left on station, and she kept up a steady rate of captures, although in summer 1813 an expedition up the river Mercerado to arrest 2 British slave traders saw the latter resist, and a full-scale battle broke out around the slave factory, a term used at the time for the fortified encampments that were used to acquire and process slaves before they were taken aboard ships. The slavers managed to escape in the confusion when the factory caught fire, but were then captured by some of the locals who, having been on the receiving end of raids by other tribes and the factory, were understandably less than pleased to see the slavers in their territory, and the slavers were handed over to the Thais. Both men would subsequently be sentenced to transportation with a 14-year sentence. More ships arrived that autumn, but they also bore new orders. The rising numbers of French and American raiders, both warships and privateers, led to the ships on the station being ordered to cruise further out to sea to more generally protect British trade. However, Captain Maxwell of the 16-gun sloop HMS Favourite decided to creatively interpret these orders by declaring that with the other ships on those distant patrol stations, one of the best ways he could protect British trade was to disrupt enemy trade, and since enemy trade in this area was mostly in slaves, that meant he was going after the slavers. After capturing a number of slaver ships, he sent his crew in boats up the river Pongas, where they burned 9 slave factories and chased any surviving slavers up the river. However, this operation alone cost the lives of 16 men to various fevers and other diseases, a common pattern in these operations. And later in that year, political interference flared up again, with so many slaver ships being taken, particularly Portuguese slavers caught breaking the recent treaty. Their backers had managed to lobby the Foreign Secretary to instruct the Navy not to intercept ships under the Portuguese flag. Captain Irby decided this was a stupid decision, since of course it would mean that every slaver in the area would quickly learn to fly a Portuguese flag at convenience, and so he sent back a reply asking for clarification of these orders, incidentally just happening to choose a relatively slow merchant ship to carry said letter. Given the overall speed of ships and the speed of correspondence at the time, this reply was essentially a polite middle finger, as it brought the Royal Navy several more months of hunting until a response could be formulated and a ship found to take that response back to Captain Irby, and then the responding ship actually had to find him. This effort largely worked, and anti-slavery patrols were still going strong in 1814 as the situation for the Royal Navy globally began to improve. With Napoleon being forced to abdicate and go into exile, by May of that year there was a general peace in Europe and the single largest commitment of the Royal Navy, the blockade of Europe, could be ended, freeing up huge amounts of resources. Some of these were dispatched across the Atlantic to increasingly tighten the blockade of the US East Coast, as the incredibly poorly named War of 1812 was still going in 1814, although by the end of the year negotiations were well underway to end that war as well, with a sticking point being the British pushing for greater abilities to go after slave ships flying the US flag in peacetime, with the US in turn resisting this, in part because British warships boarding American vessels was ostensibly part of the reason the two nations had gone to war in the first place. In the end, the two countries agreed to use their best endeavours to end the slave trade, a rather woolly term that the US felt it could use to just mostly go back to what it had done before, which wasn't much, while the British felt that they could use the term to justify inspections of suspected slavers under the Stars and Stripes, at least if they could reasonably claim they thought they were flying false colours. However, peace with the USA also unintentionally brought an additional problem for the Royal Navy's anti-slavery patrols, as during the war, US shipwrights had tuned the Boston Clipper into a near-perfect fast blockade runner. With the blockade of the US coast gone, these vessels now had to look for other lucrative trade opportunities, and soon many found employment in the hands of slavers, who aimed to use their speed and shallow draft to evade and outrun British warships, the relatively small size of the clippers being less of an issue when they were moving relatively low volume but high value cargo, like slaves. Elsewhere, though, the British were exerting diplomatic pressure on various nations to help end slavery as part of the peace agreements to end the various conflicts in Europe. Spain, for example, agreed to cease allowing foreign vessels to use its flag for protection and to therefore disavow any foreign slaver who claimed to be under the Spanish flag. The French were forced to agree to abolish their own slave trade entirely on or before 1820, and Portugal agreed to allow the British broader powers to seize slavers who were contravening the 1810 treaty, and in principle they also agreed to end their own slave trade, but that was penciled in for an indeterminate point in the future, and there wasn't a huge amount of movement by the Portuguese to actually go through with that element. Additionally, at the Congress of Vienna, the British managed to get all the major European powers to sign on to the idea of abolishing the slave trade as soon as possible, although exactly how each power interpreted as soon as possible had to be left up to them. A major issue was soon realised, as with the war with France over, there was technically no longer any right for Royal Navy patrols to seize French-flagged ships, and with the slave populations in French colonies having been depleted due to lack of resupply during the war years, there was suddenly a surge in French slaving voyages, even as the new French government was arguing within itself over whether or not to abolish their slave trade. The peace also meant that some French colonies were being returned to France, and that of course meant fewer Royal Navy bases and more slave ports. By the end of 1814, the Royal Navy ships on station consisted of two sloops, the Brisk and Comus, and two frigates, the Porcupine and Ulysses. In particular, Porcupine had been experiencing some success in fighting off malaria, the main cause of fatalities on the station, as the captain had managed to acquire a supply of cinchona bark from Spanish South America. This was a natural source of quinine, and he was making sure that anybody who went ashore was then issued with several days of cinchona bark tea. Also a welcome development was the beginning of cooperation with reformed traders, a number of British ex-slaving companies having turned to trading in things like palm oil, which was in increasing demand as a lubricant for the growing Industrial Revolution. And early in 1815, these traders sent complaints from their various outposts on the old Calabar River that their ships were being delayed in loading their cargo due to the many slavers on the river, who were both offering more money for expedited loading and also were accused of kidnapping some of the palm oil traders' own workers and putting them aboard the slave ships as additional slaves. Comus duly arrived to investigate and very quickly spotted two schooners near the river entrance. Comus headed after one and sent one of her boats after the other. The boat approached the schooner Dos Amigos and ordered it to heave to. There was no response, so warning shots were fired across the bow. The schooner then hoisted a Portuguese flag, but Comus's first lieutenant in the boat fired another warning shot, as the revised treaty didn't give the schooner the protection it sought given its location. The schooner then escalated by opening fire on the Royal Navy boat. The men in the boat returned fire, and the schooner wheeled to present its other broadside, fired that, then wheeled about again, But this time the wind died, leaving it dead in the water and soon subject to boarding by a very angry boat crew who, of course, had oars. The ship actually turned out to be Spanish, thus flying false colours, and it was duly taken as a prize. The other schooner had escaped when Comus had turned back to help out its boat, and so Comus recovered the boat and headed to the river estuary. Dropping anchor in the estuary to act as a backstop against any escaping vessels, Comus sent out two boats to scout upriver, and here they discovered no less than 5 slave ships, 3 Spanish and 2 Portuguese, including the schooner that had escaped earlier. Now well prepared for resistance, the British boats made to board quickly, and after a 10-minute battle of musketry, all 5 ships were taken. Elsewhere, the Ulysses discovered 2 slave factories being run by British slavers. In both cases, the slavers managed to escape into the interior, but Ulysses' crew, rather than spend days pointlessly searching the African landscape, simply took anything of value from the factories they could find, and then burnt the factories to the ground. By summer 1815, the Royal Navy ships had taken a dozen or so additional slaver ships, but the resumption of war in Europe and the wear and tear on their vessels meant that by July only Comus was left on station. However, she did manage to take another couple of slavers in August before she had to head home herself, leaving the patrols temporarily to the Dolores, an ex-slave schooner that had been captured by the Ulysses and turned against its former trade. Dolores and the Princess Charlotte, a schooner that was run directly by the Sierra Leone colony, were left to hold the fort until the 20-gun frigate HMS Ban arrived in early 1816. The Princess Charlotte was also under a new commander, as Lieutenant Hagen, formerly First Lieutenant of the Porcupine, had transferred over to her to take command when Porcupine had sailed back to the UK. Along with another small colonial vessel, the sloop Mary, the ships stepped up their efforts, especially as more and more slavers were actively fighting back against attempts to seize them. This came to a head after several other incidents when the Mary, Princess Charlotte, and a captured prize temporarily put into service as a supply ship began hunting the Compadore, a slave ship that had decided to circumvent many of the close inshore patrols by simply pirating other slave ships out at sea and seizing their slaves to take itself. Instead, they found themselves chasing a slaver brig, which flew under French colours, that fired on multiple boats that tried to approach it and only surrendered when it was subjected to several full broadsides. By mid-1816, the Ban was forced to sail home for a refit and was replaced by the 36-gun Inconstant under the command of Commodore Sir James Yeo, who students of history probably better know for commanding the British efforts on the Great Lakes during the War of 1812. Although only on station for a few months before the ship was reassigned elsewhere, Yeo's frigate managed to capture another 4 slaver ships, while the Princess Charlotte was declared too worn out for further service. But the brig Louis, the one that had fought back just earlier, was renamed Prince Regent and commissioned as a replacement for her. Under the command of Lieutenant Hagen, the ship captured 5 more slave ships that year, including the La Paz, which tried to resist the boarding efforts with the ship's master stabbing Hagen in the hand when the latter ordered him to surrender, so Hagen shot him, and the next most senior man aboard the slaver suddenly proved far more amenable to the idea of giving up. By early 1817, the Inconstant was back, and Ban's crew were also back, although they were now in the 26-gun HMS Cherub. By this point, a large portion of slave ships were either ex-Baltimore clippers and thus able to outrun the British ships in most weather conditions, or they were increasingly heavily armed, including one who openly boasted about tracking down the Inconstant and sinking her, but then proved rather less bold when Inconstant showed up off the coast the slaver was operating near, with the British vessel declaring that it was looking for a fight. By the end of 1817, Inconstant was fairly heavily worn out, and so she sailed home for the crew to transfer over to the Semiramis, but once again political interference reared its head. This time the Foreign Office sent out orders not to intercept any French-flagged vessel that wasn't known or heavily suspected to be a pirate, with a caveat that was clearly designed to counter the most likely immediate response of Royal Navy captains, as the Foreign Office further stated that slavery was not to be considered as piracy. This setback was mitigated to a small degree by Portugal agreeing to prohibit foreign slavers from trading with Portugal, which essentially reduced the Portuguese slave trade to Portuguese ships only trading between Portuguese-held territories, along with reasonably generous provisions for the Royal Navy to search ships flying the Portuguese flag who were suspected of using it as cover, or if they thought those ships were trading outside the mandated areas. There was greater progress elsewhere, though. Spain, under diplomatic pressure, agreed to abolish its slave trade by 1820 and immediately end all slave trading north of the equator, although the immediate effects of both the Spanish and Portuguese treaties was actually a rise in the number of slavers as they tried to beat the deadlines of implementation on the various agreements. However, Lieutenant Hagen, now in the Prince Regent, decided that this simply meant he was in a target-rich area, and over the course of the remainder of 1817, he took seven more slavers before yet more political interference stepped in, as the Foreign Office, it's suggested by some sources under the influence of those who wanted to try and pause the patrols or even roll back the ban on the trade, had ordered that only ships carrying copies of the newly drafted special instructions on the conduct of anti-slavery patrols were allowed to capture slave ships. And of course, conveniently, none of the ships on station had any copies yet, which would have to wait for new ships to be dispatched from the UK with freshly printed copies of said instructions. However, in 1818, the return of the Cherub, as well as the Semiramis showing up, saw a few more captures, as they also distributed copies of the special instructions, with many of the captures being among Spanish vessels which had decided to ignore the provisions of the new treaty and were becoming increasingly piratical as well as running slaves. Luckily, the firepower of the two Royal Navy frigates was more than up to the task, although Captain Wills of the Cherub, and yes, for those of you who are asking, that is the same Cherub that helped capture the USS Essex in the War of 1812, faced significant problems when the owners of one of the ships he'd seized sued him for wrongful capture. They conspired to have all the witnesses of the ship's illegal actions forbidden from actually giving evidence on the somewhat shaky grounds that they were Africans, and somehow this meant that they weren't eligible to give evidence. Subsequently, obviously, without any witnesses to the ship's actions, they were able to win the case against Captain Wills. Fortunately, on appeal, the initial ruinous judgment of over £21,000 against him personally was set aside and reduced to merely just over £6,500, which was still a colossal amount, but which was largely covered by the sale of goods from the seized ship, with the Treasury helpfully agreeing to cover the remaining small sum, which allowed Wills to resume commanding his ship. Also in 1818 came a treaty with the Netherlands that would ban the Dutch slave trade by the end of the year, but the 1818 also saw the death of Sir James Yeo, yet another victim of the various diseases endemic to the West African coast. Additionally, an attempt to get more cooperation from the Americans over the right to seize slavers operating under the US flags came to nothing. But towards the end of the year, the frigate Tartar arrived with instructions from the Admiralty to use all established British laws and treaties and every other means to prevent the slave trade. Although very vague, it seems the Admiralty was chafing quite a bit under the constant additional restrictions sent down from the Foreign Office, and was thus giving Commander Collier, aboard Tartar, instructions which he could choose to deliberately interpret to his benefit, presumably relying on the still slow communications network to give him plenty of buffer time against further attempts to stop him if he became far too successful for certain interests' liking. Along with HMS Pheasant, a number of slavers were duly taken, including one that was Portuguese and turned out to belong to a Portuguese governor who was using the island he governed as a base for slaving, including quite a lot of slaving that was now banned by treaty. The arrival of four more ships helped, especially the fast-sailing Myrmidon, which caught half a dozen slavers in just a month, then sent boats ashore to Sherbrooke Island, with their crews instructed to infiltrate the slavers operating there, pretending to be an American slaving crew. Here they found an Irish slaver who had previously worked in Freetown itself and had maintained contacts there who kept him informed as to Royal Navy ship sailings. This information he then either sold on at a premium to other slavers or used it to conduct slaving runs himself. He was duly made a priority target as soon as the Royal Navy crew returned to their ship. And so 1819 turned into 1820, which would prove to be yet another busy year for the Royal Navy, but would also see the arrival of new ships to help in the efforts as the US Navy showed up for the first time to conduct their own anti-slavery patrols. But that's a story for another time. Let me know in the comments below if you'd like me to continue this little series, as there's quite a lot of information to go since, these slavery patrols were conducted throughout most of the 19th century.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.